You may proceed.
Good morning, Chief Justice Lemons, esteemed justices of the Virginia Supreme Court. My name is Christopher Brown. It is my pleasure to appear before you today on behalf of Tamara Young Allen and her appeal of the two orders of Judge Kemmler from Alexandria Circuit Court. Those orders, as stated in Assignment of Error 1, made an interesting distinction or a problem point with respect to the recording of a Liz Pendens and the filing of a suit prior to a foreclosure sale.
Does the Liz Pendens act as a preliminary injunction in your mind?
It does not.
Well, then, did you ask for a TRO?
I did not. And that's a function, really, Your Honor, of the difference between, for example, Fairfax Circuit Court in Alexandria or Loudoun that doesn't have an emergency docket. When you want to do an emergency hearing in a circuit court, unlike Fairfax that has the 8:30 a.m. calendar control docket, you have to file an emergency motion and wait for a call from Chambers to come in and say, hey, we'll see you at 3 o'clock. And oftentimes with these foreclosures, you're coming down to the wire. You're speaking to the trustee's office, and you're saying, look.
So you didn't have a week's notice to file a TRO or a preliminary injunction?
Well, it's not that I didn't have a week's notice. You're more proceeding with the understanding that when you give notice of the dispute to the trustee, you will be able to persuade them that they're going to cancel the sale.
Well, they didn't, and they didn't have, absent some sort of injunctive proceeding, they didn't have any obligation to do it simply because you asked them to.
That is correct, which is the point I wish to make when I address the arguments made by equity, when they want to characterize my argument as saying that a mere notice of a dispute automatically means a trustee has breached his duty if it proceeds to sale. That is not my argument. My argument is, when you present a dispute to a trustee, and this point was so wonderfully restated in your recent opinion of Crosby versus ALG trustees in 2017, the trustee has a choice. It has to review the dispute it's been presented with, and it can make a decision. And all this area of the law means is, if they choose to go forward and it turns out the court disagrees with them and they were wrong, they'll have to pay the attorney's fees for the borrower.
No, the legal standard changes dramatically after a sale.
It does, which is why the Liz Pendens is important, as it preserves the status quo of the party at the time the Liz Pendens is recorded, meaning the purchaser will take title subject to the claims presented before the sale.
But the Liz Pendens does not freeze frame the nature of the cause of action. The Liz Pendens just says whatever you have later, you have now. Whatever you have now, you have later.
And when we discuss preserving the status quo of the parties, that preserves my client's position as to title. In other words, prior to being subjected to the contractual right held by Paramount to enforce the memorandum of sale and go to closing. So that's when it preserves the status quo, is prior to that right of the third party arising, and it freezes time, the rights of the parties when the Liz Pendens is recorded. This is what I feel the distinction that Kemmler made where she erred. There's heavy reliance on the Ramos opinion from this court, which is my case. Now, this court recalls, in that case, I was trying to slip in a little window there, post-hammer falling, pre-closing. The title has not yet passed. The purchaser is not a bona fide purchaser for value at that point. They haven't closed yet. And therefore, I should be able to get title back on an allegation of a breach that's not necessarily a material breach, which I could do pre-sale. And this court ruled against it, that once the hammer falls, there's a contractual right to go to sale for the purchaser to go to closing. And I hadn't alleged a material breach or fraud, collusion, or inadequate sales price. Understood.
Did the hammer fall here?
The hammer fell after the Liz Pendens was recorded, when the rights of the parties were frozen.
So you, but in a nutshell, you drop a Liz Pendens on an equity action where there's going to be equitable relief asked for, and none of the rules on timing apply just because the Liz Pendens is there?
Well, all the rules apply, but the rights of the parties are frozen at the point in time when the Liz Pendens is recorded. So I don't have to deal with, and this creates a troubling precedent.
Suppose a BFP without notice buys the property.
Well, Well, they can't be that with the reporting of list pendants, because by law, the public is given notice of the claims if I'm reporting.
So the list pendants really does have a staining effect, as you understand it, in preserving every pre-sale cause of action in a pre-sale context, even though it's post-sale.
Only those causes of action or disputes of which the trustee is given notice, or that are in the complaint itself when it's filed, because he gives notice of the complaint that's in the land records. The list pendants gives notice of the complaint that's been filed with the clerk's office. You have to put a case number on it. You can't file it.
The list pendants only give notice of the complaint. You just indicated
correct.
It was a compound notice. It simply says, I've got a lawsuit, and here it is.
Yes.
And it doesn't go beyond the four corners of that lawsuit.
That is correct.
And its merits or lack of merits.
That is correct.
Okay.
Absolutely right.
But this complaint that's filed is contesting something that didn't happen yet.
Yes.
It's very clever in some respects, but I understand what you're trying to do. Wouldn't a petition for an injunction with a list pendant have been more accurate as to what's happening?
It would be more accurate.
Well, your complaint is not accurate. What you're saying is you want rescission to take place when you filed the complaint, and the sale hadn't happened yet.
Well, Chief Justice, let me point this out. When I originally filed the complaint, it was just a breach of contract action against the bank, expecting that the sale would be stopped. When the sale proceeded, I amended to question to rescind, because at that time the sale has gone forward.
Well, yeah, you did it after the fact. I understand
yes.
that. It went forward, and nobody objected to the amendment. So I suspect what I denominate it as very clever, it was not objected to, and so we're here on the amended complaint and not the complaint, and that is after, arguably after the sale. Now, this sale hasn't been consummated even today, has it?
That is correct, and I want to point out that the amended complaint does revert back to the original complaint, and the sale has not yet gone to closing, as Equity argued in their opposition brief. They allege that their decision to not go to closing is why they have maintained the status quo, and I shouldn't be entitled to rely on Hudson v. Barham and get attorney's fees for their failure to cancel.
Well, with this in sort of an equipoise, where the deed hasn't been passed?
It has not.
Right. So is this pre-sale or post-sale?
Pre-sale.
Right.
However, they went forward.
And it was sold at auction, and the hammer fell.
And
it's just they haven't walked back into the room and executed the proper paperwork. Why didn't you file an injunction proceeding? Because that's the way it's supposed to work.
Because
you don't want it to happen, you file an injunction. And if you're in a court that is hurry up, then you hurry up.
I didn't feel I would have gotten a call from Chambers to come in that afternoon. And unfortunately, the way this works out is...
You didn't have any more notice than the morning before?
Well, no more notice that the trustee wasn't going to cancel.
How long has she not been paying the mortgage before the foreclosure sale? How many months had she not been paying the mortgage, approximately?
7 or 9, although I don't think that's relevant, respectfully, Your Honor.
Well, if she's not paying the mortgage and they're planning to do a foreclosure and you wait the day before and just drop a list pendants and that's it, and they go forward with the auction, why did it stun you that the trial judge in this case said, you know what, if you'd gotten here on time, I would have done something. You had plenty of time to get here. But you're a day late and a dollar short.
For a couple of reasons. One, I respectfully submit I got there on time. When I report to list pendants, it preserves the rights of the parties at that time. Number two, when we understand, this is why I put these paragraphs in my complaints about working with the bank and the problems with the loan modification process and the missing documents. They string these homeowners, and I want to say it in a way that may be perceived as too adversarial. There are issues with the loan modification process that drag these issues out, and they drag on, and there's new documents, and you need to submit this. And then at the last minute, you'll see my Exhibit C to the amended complaint. She expressly says, just give me the amount I have to owe, I want to pay. And when they don't give that to her, and I contact the trustee to say, look, she's asked for the reinstatement figures, just get them to us. And their office, oh, we'll speak to the servicer. And what happens is a day, 2 days before the sale, I'm calling saying, you're going to cancel the sale, aren't you? We need to reinstate. no, we're not going to cancel. Boom, it's the day before the sale. I'm not going to be able to file something and get Judge Kembler's chambers to contact me and say, the judge will see you at 4 o'clock. And the foreclosure is the next day in the morning, so I put a complaint to Liz Pendens in with the allegations that there's a bit of material breach of the deed of trust and denying the right to cure. And preserving the party's rights at that time, and even using the argument that Bank of America makes in its brief, they say, the general allegations, this is at page 12, they're citing Parrish. General allegations that the trustee breached its duty is insufficient. You must allege that the DOT requirements breached. I did. The trustee failed to comply. I did. I told them, there's been a denial of the right to cure. You need to cancel the sale. And that was their failure to comply with the requirements of the deed of trust, which, thanks to the Crosby versus ALG trustees case, reminded the circuit courts, particularly the Eastern District of Virginia, that the duties are both explicit and implicit, and it's been that way for 200 years, and I thank you for it.
You leave here, walk across the street, because the General Assembly is taking up a bill to reverse Crosby versus ALG in the next few days. But that has nothing to do with this case.
Until that happens. And the third problem is the person knew or should have known. So I satisfied all three of those prompts.
Did you plead, as Ramos required, that, look, if I'd gotten the notice of cure that you claim was not given, if I'd gotten the reinstatement figures which you claim that the contractual documents required them to give you at a certain point, if you'd gotten all those things, you would have cured. You'd have paid it all off without dispute and everything would be happy. Did you plead causation?
I believe that reading the complaint in the light most favorable to the appellate, Ms. Young Allen, when we attach her a letter, Exhibit C, that says, please send me my reinstatement figures so I can pay, that is sufficient to support that she pointed out, had this been done.
Was that in the amended, that wasn't in the original complaint, was that in the amended complaint?
I don't recall, Your Honor, and unfortunately the original complaint is not a part of the record. I also want to point this out. I believe that that's something that occurs after the demurrer is overruled. The Court of Equity will then review to determine whether or not it's equitable to rescind the sale. Meaning, as long as I pled it right, material breach of the deed of trust, failure of the denial of the right to cure, we overrule the demurrer, and then the court equitably looks at it. And I've had this happen, where the court says, if you don't have the money to reinstate, I'm not going to waste everybody's time and rescind this, and then dismiss the case. But we didn't get there. But the demurrer should not be sustained. The court of the equity court should look at the equities after the demurrer is overruled.
So, again, rescission in your mind is a cause of action. It's not a remedy. It's not an equitable remedy that attaches to a breach of contract or a fiduciary breach or some other cause of action. It is a freestanding cause of action.
My understanding is, and
that's a novel theory, at least to me.
Well, I've relied on the Squires versus Virginia Housing Development Authority case, and I believe in that case the cause of action was equitable action to rescind based on an underlying breach of contract.
Right, and a breach of contract is you have a contractual duty, you breached it, and there's damages, causation. You can't have a breach of contract remedy of any kind, equitable or legal, absent damages, which means you've got to prove if you had done what you should have done, I wouldn't have been harmed.
You know, there are two forms of damages. One, loss of title alone is an injury, as this court has ruled. I didn't cite that case, I'm sorry. Second, it's paragraph 26 of the amended complaint.
Loss of title alone is sufficient for damages?
Is an injury.
So you would never have to show any damages
other
than there's a foreclosure.
No, it's loss of property. The loss of property is losing.
So that's the only, so therefore, in any case of this nature, the mere fact of the foreclosure means no proof of damages is ever necessary.
The issue I've dealt with when I try to make that point, Your Honor, is whether or not there was equity in the property. And what the circuit courts have found is if there's no equity in the property, they don't find any damage when I've raised that point. I'm not saying I agree with that. I have not appealed that issue, but it would be drilled down to that point. In other words, was there a loss? If the house is underwater, then you've lost nothing.
And that's actually the fact pattern in Crosby versus ALG.
Yes.
It was the showing of large equity and an unfair purchase price.
And the damages alleged in this complaint in paragraph 26, which is the appendix page 4, are the costs and attorney's fees in having to go to court because the trustee breached his duty in failing to cancel. And those legitimate damages established by Hudson v. Barham, which is 1903, and equity criticizes
that presupposes a breach. It presupposes a breach of the trust agreement, the contracts. It imposes a breach of contract claim. You just don't have attorney's fees just because you file suit.
Go ahead. I see my time is up.
But I think the question is still pending.
If that's
the case, you have the opportunity to answer it.
It does, which gets to this point of, I'm not saying that notifying a trustee of a dispute automatically means you have, you know, it effectively paralyzes the system. They have a choice to make. They disagree this is a legitimate dispute, or they feel maybe we should seek the assistance of the courts, as this court said they should in a legitimate dispute in Hudson v. Barham. If they choose to go forward and it turns out they were wrong, they are liable for attorney's fees. And the Bremer v. Bittner Circuit Court opinion is interesting because the homeowner went and got an injunction, and it was granted, and the homeowner was able to get attorney's fees. And they cite the Wilner v. Dimer opinion from the Fourth Circuit in 2017. I, in some sense, felt that Crosby was a response to that opinion, because they note in a footnote that cited that they felt that Bremer v. Bittner deviated from Virginia law. But I think that's exactly how it has to be, because this is the point.
You've answered the question. Thank you very much.
Can I answer your question as well?
Yes, Chief. Yeah.
All right. Your time is expired.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Patrick Harvey, arguing on behalf of the Appellee Bank of America N.A. I think as the prior questioning demonstrated, Ms. Young Allen is seeking extraordinary relief. She did not go to court and get an injunction to try to stop a foreclosure sale. Instead, she is seeking to cancel a sale that is already consummated, as Ramos said, after the hammer dropped and a third-party purchaser purchased the property. The sole basis she claims for being able to get this extraordinary remedy is an alleged failure to send a notice to cure and a notice that she could reinstate the loan. But as the questioning revealed, she never alleged that she could actually reinstate the loan and avoid foreclosure.
Well, the response to that point, which is an important point, is, well, there was an allegation that, send me the deficiency or whatever it was, the payoff something, and then I'll make it good. And so in the light most favorable to her, it's an inference of the complaint, she would have been able to pay. What do you respond to that?
Right. And I don't think that's a reasonable inference here, because there was a demur to an original complaint, to a breach of contract claim, that basically said, this case is just like Ramos. You need to plead the amount of damages, and you need to specify your injury stemming from not reinstating. So everyone was on notice saying, if you include an allegation that says, I could reinstate the loan and I could avoid foreclosure. But that didn't occur here. So I don't think that would be a reasonable inference from the pleadings, nor do I think
it was that in the amended complaint? I'm sorry, I should know this, but was the send me the payoff amount and I can meet it, was that part of the amended complaint?
No, nowhere in the amended complaint does she say I can reinstate the loan. There's an email to the servicer, I'm probably not the proper party, that says, can you please send me a reinstatement quote? It does not say, I'm asking for a reinstatement quote because I intend to reinstate. And she could have included in the amended complaint, yes, I could reinstate and I could have avoided foreclosure. And the only reason I couldn't is because the servicer or the lender failed to send me that quote. But that's nowhere in the pleadings.
If the deed of trust says that they're supposed to get that quote, why wouldn't you just give it to them?
Candidly, if not in the record, there was a cure notice and a reinstatement quote that was sent earlier. And that could be, I think there's generally an obligation to provide a reinstatement quote, but it's not every time you ask, you need to get one immediately. There's just an obligation to send it. But it's not necessarily a condition precedent for foreclosure.
When was the prior one sent? You said it was sent previously. How long before?
Again, this is not in the record, so I want to be clear. But it was December 2018, I believe, and then there was a notice of the foreclosure, which is attached to the amended complaint as Exhibit A, or notice of the trustee sale, and that was in early January. And I think that goes to the broader point that was raised of why couldn't you get an injunction? You know, we had the trustee sent a notice of a sale in early January. She was in default well before that. So there was plenty of time to try to get to court. So we're not stuck in this position where we're trying to unwind a sale and take a third-party purchaser's rights in a property. And because she doesn't allege that she could reinstate the loan, I think at the end of the day, she's asking for an equitable, you know, to cancel a sale based on an alleged technical breach from which she suffered no injury. And I have never found any case
in which she does not even allege she suffered injury.
Correct.
Am I right that the last document, the last exhibit, which appears to be Exhibit C, is the email that is being discussed?
Yes. Yes, that was the particular request for reinstatement. And again, I just don't think it's a reasonable inference to make that she could reinstate the loan. I think that's something she has to expressly allege, especially considering the context of the original complaint.
You mentioned technical breach. Do you acknowledge that it's a technical breach?
If not sending a reinstatement quote would be a breach of contract, yes. I think I'm not conceding that that's what happened here, but if because we're at a demur, we'll assume that she's correct that that the right to reinstate was not informed of her. Yes, the deed of trust says that the borrower has the right to reinstate until 5 days before foreclosure.
Well, now you're not saying that she didn't raise the issue of the breach of various notices required by the deed of trust in the amended complaint. You're not saying that.
No, that's not what I'm saying at all.
All right, because that's in paragraph 18. So may I assume then what you're saying is that there's no specific requested remedy in the amended complaint that relates to that allegation. Is that what you're saying?
I think it's a little bit different, and I'll try. I think the allegation is we have a valid contract. I don't think anyone's arguing that the deed of trust is valid. We have an alleged breach. You were supposed to send me a cure notice and tell me about the notice to reinstate. And I have the right to reinstate up to 5 days before foreclosure. But what we don't have is an allegation that this alleged failure to send this notice caused her any injury because of the breach. It's only an injury. You only need a notice to reinstate if you have the ability to reinstate the loan, because the injury would then be you wrongly foreclosed on me, and then there would be the available remedy of damages. I believe that happened in the Bayview case. They didn't receive notice of the foreclosure, and the lender was on the hook for $160,000 damages. But here we don't have damages because there's no allegation or proof, or sorry, no allegation. I'm not worried about proof. That
well, excuse me. I want to get my question in context here. She does say that there's a breach of fiduciary duty, and she requests the court to award $50,000 in damages plus attorney's fees and costs to be paid. Now that's the relief requested, and the prior paragraphs are referenced. 18 says Bank of America failed to send required notices to her as required by the deed of trust specifically. Specifically, the requirement that it send her a notice of the right to cure, state the amount that it must be paid, where it must be sent, and the date by which the figure is good to reinstate or cure. With that allegation, the remedy requested is $50,000 in damages, attorney's fees and costs to be paid by equity for the breach of its fiduciary duty. Where's the disconnect?
The answer is actually relatively simple. That claim is not brought against Bank of America. There's no claim for rescission against Bank of America, and there's no breach of fiduciary duty. And I think that particular relief, as it is stated in the complaint, applies only to the breach of fiduciary duty claim brought against equity, not the equitable rescission claim that's brought against Bank of America.
Well, you have requested, and we granted a separate argument on behalf of equity.
Mm-hmm.
You have 38 more seconds on your clock.
I think I will highlight again that this one other point I'd like to highlight is counsel raised the issue that the recording of a Liz Pendens is the relevant moment for constructive notice. And in fact, under Virginia Code annotated 8.01268, is actually the indexing of the Liz Pendens, which is important, which codifies Vickers v. Saylor, which was actually cited by Apley's brief. I'm out of time. Thank you very much.
All right.
Good morning, Justices. May it please the Court, my name is Robert Michael. I'm arguing on behalf of Equity Trustees. Because Equity was the party that conducted the foreclosure sale at issue, I'd like to address primarily the breach of fiduciary duty claim, and I would say that there is a significant defect in pleading for that breach of fiduciary duty claim. First, to get to the elements of a breach of fiduciary duty claim, you have to have a duty, and that arises from the deed of trust. Certainly, there are duties specifically out there in and in the Virginia Code. But the underlying duty at issue here is a duty of perfect fairness and impartiality. That duty has existed for over two centuries in Virginia, and Equity Trustees does not deny that there is such a duty. But what was the breach of that duty? According to Ms. Allen, the breach of that duty was proceeding to sale when there is an alleged defect. And that by itself is not a duty. There has to actually be an underlying defect. And it has to be a material defect. Counsel, when he was arguing on behalf of Ms. Allen, makes a fairly novel, and it may have passed the court's notice. He says, if I file something pre-sale that may not be a material breach or a material defect, that wouldn't pass post-sale. And again, it only becomes a material defect if the borrower can allege, and I could have reinstated. Because in the real world, a borrower will communicate with her servicer day in and day out, over and over again. And even if the servicer provides a proper reinstatement letter on day one, and another one on day four, and another one on day eight, if the borrower requests one on day 13, and even if it hasn't changed, the lender doesn't provide a new reinstatement quote, well, all of a sudden, that's a defect with the sale, even though it's not material because she couldn't have reinstated and the amount hasn't changed. So there is a pleading defect here.
Does she plead anywhere, with the exception of attaching that one email, does she plead anywhere that had she gotten the information, had she gotten what she wants as apparently a multiple notices to cure and restatement figures, she could have done anything about it?
She does not plead that, and even Exhibit C to the amended complaint doesn't say, and I'll make it good. I think the question earlier says, well, she says send me the reinstatement figure and I'll make it good. She actually doesn't say that second part. She says, can I please get a reinstatement figure? And although it's not part of the record, apparently there have been multiple serial reinstatement figures requested in this particular matter. So that's why there is no material defect alleged with this sale. But beyond that, this really gets into how do you allege and how do you get those inferences, which the court does have to make inferences from the amended complaint, the allegations therein on demurrer. And I think the concurring opinion of Justice Mims in Squire makes the point very well. There are some inferences that can be made. Those inferences aren't available here. In particular, in that concurring opinion, I think in Squire, the court has said, well, she says that she had a value of property at $223,000, and the property was purchased by A.J. Potter for $115,000. The purchaser had made $35,420.84 in alterations to the property, late fees and costs, and these are exactly the types of things that a face-to-face meeting was designed to allow her to avoid. But there is no causal relationship or proper inference in this case that would get close to those proper inferences that I think was noted in that concurring opinion in Squire. And that's because there have been no damages here. There have been no damages pled. And counsel's point that we've made the position that a borrower merely has to allege any defect and the trustee has to stop. Well, if damages in terms of attorney's fees is sufficient to allege damages, then that is exactly the paradigm, right? If there isn't a proper basis for damages other than attorney's fees, then that's exactly the kind of law that Ms. Allen is proposing. The trustee has to stop or they're subjected to attorney's fees. And here, there are no damages because Ms. Allen hasn't been divested of title to the property. The property hasn't closed. It's Paramount Investments. And there's no allegation here. And again, there are very significant allegations in Squire versus Virginia Housing Development
Authority. In theory, after assuming you were victorious on appeal, could he file a post-consummation rescission action at that point and allege fraud and all the other things you can allege after the fact?
I don't think that Ms. Allen could file a post-consummation rescission action against Bank of America for rescission, but I will allege that and acknowledge that if the matter is affirmed as to the breach of fiduciary duty claim, Ms. Allen could, if the sale is consummated to Paramount Investments, then would have a ripe claim, if there are underlying facts that can be alleged, for breach of fiduciary duty.
Okay, so if she had some deficiency that she thought she could, some equity redemption she thought she could have kept if everything had been done according to the way she says, and if she pled it right, perhaps for the first time in this procedure, in theory, she could bring that, but that's something for another day, I take it.
I think that's exactly right. And that's why a trustee has its discretion, and again, two centuries of case law says a trustee, you know, proceeds at its discretion, and where it's wrong, it is subject to potential damages. But Equity Trustees has preserved the status quo here by not proceeding to close the sale and allowing the borrower to vindicate her rights in the circuit court if she had them. And a trustee shouldn't be held liable yet. There's no cause of action against the trustee yet. If the trustee closes the sale and there are underlying defects, which are material, which her rights were not able to be vindicated, then she should be able to assert those once it's ripe. The one other matter I'd like to mention for basically
the issue. But in theory, had she asked for a preliminary injunction and a deck action attached to it, she could have teed that up, right? But that, I mean, in theory, it can be done. The system is set up so you can have that precautionary approach.
Justice Kelsey, I see that my time's expired. May I briefly?
No, you can answer any question that's still pending. Go ahead.
Yes.
And after you finish that
you
have one other matter, and you may address that as well.
Thank you, Your Honor. That is exactly the way the system is set up, and if had it been teed up properly, had it been brought in a request for a preliminary injunction, certainly her rights could have been vindicated in that matter. Regarding the rescission matter, Paramount Investments LLC is not a party to the appeal, and we believe that is a defect with the jurisdiction in this matter. As the purchaser of the property, I'm not certain how the court can exercise jurisdiction over them when they were never properly even served in the trial court. So that may be subject of a motion to dismiss, but I think it would be remiss of me not to mention that. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you very much. Very interesting argument. Call the next case.